morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of February. This hour of the program, it's All Things Political, which you normally hear Mondays at 9 o'clock, and we will be speaking with Jeffrey Lord. Jeffrey joins us fairly frequently. He's a contributing editor to the American Spectator. He's the former Ronald Reagan White House political director. He's a former aide to Jack Kemp. And we have a lot to talk about today. We'll be looking at some of the issues that we've been discussing for quite some period of time. The economy we'll talk about. We'll talk about John Kerry being the new Secretary of State and what we expect from him. Chuck Hagel's hearing last week, how did that go? We will talk about guns again. The president will be talking about them once again today. And I thought we would start the show because I was actually reading a book while the family was watching the Super Bowl yesterday. But I want to start with football because even the president commented on football yesterday and about the long-term damage from concussions for those who play the game. Do we need to rethink our national sport? I hope Jeffrey is up for that conversation as we begin the show, and we'll welcome your phone calls on All Things Political. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to use that to leave your comments, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Jeffrey. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning there, Kathleen. Hope it's nice and cold out there.
It's a little snowy today, but it's winter.
That's good. That's good. I like that.
You like the snow?
Absolutely.
Actually,
I grew up in New England. You know, this is a must. This is why God made February.
I think you're right. And January and March and December and all of that. Well, it's with us. I hope you don't mind starting with football. I didn't think I was going to, but I kind of watched the Super Bowl yesterday because I have to in my household and I watched the ads. But I was wondering about this sport and why it's our national sport, and are we going to be seeing substantial changes in our national sport with the president talking about this long-term damage from concussions?
You know, there was an ad, I don't know if you, amidst all the Super Bowl ads, the glamorous ads and Kate Upton and all of these, GoDaddy.com hot ad there with the geek kisses the model and all this kind of stuff. In the middle of all that, there was an ad from the NFL itself. And it was very brief, and it said something like, you know, we're working to make football safe. And I was really taken aback by it. And I have to say, you know, one of the people out there in the American landscape on the conservative side who's been talking about this for a long time is Rush Limbaugh, who is a huge football fan, as you know, and came close to owning one of the NFL teams there in the middle of some controversy. But he's talked about this a great deal, more than I've heard anybody, frankly, discuss it. And he has been saying for some time that we're going to get into a situation where it's going to be the politically correct thing to do to fix football. And lo and behold, up popped this ad. And then you had the tragedy out there in California, the football player who died, and I guess they dissected his brain or something and found out that there had been damage. Football is a violent sport. And I think they take as many precautions as they possibly can. As you mentioned, I worked for Jack Kemp, and he was famously, before he got into politics, he was a quarterback for the Buffalo Bills.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack had multiple concussions, not to mention various bones were broken and all of this kind of thing over the years. Mm. And he was still an enthusiastic football fan. And I think that one of the things that you're going to have a hard time with are the football players themselves. Who really love the game and love to do all of this kind of thing. And that's before you even get to the fan base. So I think we're going to have to be careful here. The NFL will have to be careful about how they go about this. I mean, of course, everybody wants the players to be safe, but life is not a utopian specialty here, and people are going to get hurt playing football.
Why is it the American sport? Why is the fan base larger than for what appears to me to be a much more civilized sport, and that's baseball?
Yeah, and I confess, my favorite sport is baseball. I'm a Red Sox fan. As I say, I grew up in New England, and I love baseball. But, it requires great physical skill, great physical endurance, and there is that sort of, you know, thing of smacking into one another. I mean, it's a guy thing. I don't know how else.
All right.
I don't know that that's a very deep explanation. it's a guy thing, and you know, kids are playing this from the you know, the moment they can get out there. I mean, I was driving somewhere not long ago during the day, and it was obviously you know, an athletic timeout at a nearby school, and there were kids on the schoolyard playing football. I mean, it's like mom and apple pie. I don't know how they're going to be able to change this. I think it's sort of an instinctive deal. I mean, if we were not in America, the equivalent sport would be soccer if you were over in Europe.
Right.
And that too is a very rough and tumble mm-hmm. game. And, of course, they play that with no protection whatsoever. And people get quite passionate. It's amazing to me the riots you see in Europe when a soccer team. I mean, I am always astounded by that. I just think it's a human instinct, the competitive instinct, the urge to, you know, get rid of some energy and all of this kind of thing. And I don't think you're ever going to be able to cure that. And so I think they probably have to be careful about this as they try and figure out what to do. You know, Lyndon Johnson once said about Gerald Ford, who played football for the University of Michigan. But the problem with Jerry Ford was that he played too much football without his helmet on. So, you know, even then, I suspect the idea that people could get damaged playing football was out there. But what they'll do about it, I have no idea. But I assume that something is going to occur here.
Do you think it's wrong for the president to step into this fray?
Well, you know, presidents like to do that. I think it's only wrong in the sense that it gives the impression that he can do something about it. And, of course, I don't really think that's the case. But, you know, the president, whoever is the president, is the president. And I remember Ronald Reagan opened some football game with a little televised speech that they'd asked him to do, a little, you know, cheery hello type of thing. You know, it's part of the spectacle, and presidents are sort of on the sidelines, and they watch like everybody else, and they get asked for comment, and so they do.
Mm-hmm. I remember interviewing Ronald Reagan's son in the wonderful book that he wrote about his 100th birthday, saying that who his father was really a lifeguard, and that it governed
yes.
who he was, and I thought that was a wonderful description of him.
He rescued, I don't know how many people, 11, 12, some interesting number of people from the Rock River in Illinois mm-hmm. when he was a lifeguard. And I know that one of his biographers said that was the key to his personality, was that he loved to be the guy that went in there to rescue, and he thought he was rescuing America, you know, much later in life. I thought it was a very interesting analogy.
Yeah, I think it is, too. All right, where should we start with all of the other news, although I'm sure a couple people want to talk about football. Well, let's talk about guns, because it's omnipresent. The president will be speaking again today, I believe, in Minneapolis. Where do we stand on all of this, on universal background checks, elimination of certain types of assault weapons? What did you think of the hearings, and where do you think we go as a nation?
Well, you know, in truth, to cut right to the political chase, I don't think much of anything is going to happen, to
really?
Be perfectly candid. I just don't think that I think the American people as a whole have very strong feelings on this. I went in, of all places, the other day to pay the heat bill, and the guy who was there walking, you know, working for the oil company, came out and said he had to leave. He says, God, everybody in here is talking about guns.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. I mean, so I think this conversation is going on everywhere, and of course this was a terrible thing that happened in Newtown. The question is, can this kind of thing be stopped? And, again, I think you're getting into, you know, we're coaxing ourselves into a belief that if we only do A, B, or C, such and such isn't going to happen. During the time that we had this assault weapons ban that President Clinton had initiated, I think Columbine happened during that time period. You're never going to be able to deal with this in a way that I think, you know, eliminates all of this kind of thing. And frankly, you know, this business of saving one life, I mean, there's more going on in the city of Chicago all by itself with guns than there is, you know, around the country. And those, I assume, are mostly handguns. This is a real problem, but you get to issues of the constitutional and that kind of thing, and I think people feel very strongly. And frankly, one of the things that I think people may not be aware of, there are a lot of Democrats in Congress. I mean, Harry Reid being
yes.
a case in point, who have these, you know, A-plus ratings from the NRA. And, you know, people in Nevada like to shoot guns. And I think you're going to find a lot of resistance from the Democratic side of the aisle, and that's before you even get to the Republican side of the aisle.
What did Ronald Reagan, who was shot, have to say about all of this when after he was shot?
Yeah, he did write a letter later on, I think, after he was president. I want to say it was in about 1994, and it might have been on the assault weapons thing. And I think he signed the letter with President Ford, former President Ford, and former President Carter, urging some sort of action on this. I don't think that he essentially changed his mind about gun control. I know that I think Mrs. Reagan certainly did.
Right.
And, of course, there was a great deal of sensitivity to the fact that Jim Brady had been shot. And, you know, to this day, I believe the White House press room is named for Jim Brady. And I happen to know Jim Brady before all of this. And, you know, he was a most remarkable man. And, I mean, it truly was a tragedy. Yet again, you know, here we go. Have these things been prohibited by all of this? Have things changed? Have they stopped, et cetera? And again, you know, it's not unlike football. To try and change human nature is a very bad thing, or is a very difficult thing to do. And I noticed just this morning there's a story, and I frankly didn't know who this was, a guy by the name of Chris Kyle, who was a sniper over in Iraq and served four tours
right.
of duty in Iraq. And this morning we find out that, you know, he's long since back in the States, and he was working with soldiers to help get them, you know, reacclimated to civilian life and all this. And one of these soldiers with post-traumatic stress, apparently, was at a shooting range with him and then turned the rifle on him and killed him.
Right.
And someone else.
Yeah.
So, you know, the ability to stop this kind of thing, I think, is beyond us. And I think, politically speaking, there are a lot of people out there who are very sensitive to their Second Amendment rights. And that's why I'm not sure this is going to go anywhere.
Don't you think as well, though, Jeffrey, that a lot of people are sensitive and are worried about the safety of their children, and the Sandy Hook incident really unnerved people, and for nothing to be done would also be problematic for many others in this country?
Yeah, I do think this is. I have relatives who are educators, and you know, one of them was telling me over Christmas that she's an administrator in a elementary or junior high school, and how they rearrange their offices after this. So
mm-hmm.
if there's any particular incident that, you know, so and so would be in one place and so would be in another place. I do think we're going to get to a point. You know, Wayne LaPierre was ridiculed when he said that the school should have armed guards. But I think over time here, you know, there's going to be a lot of common sense that, you know, good Lord, we have armed guards in banks. We have armed guards all over the place. You can't walk into, when I go into New York to do media interviews, you can't walk into, like, CNN without going past an armed guard. So all these people who are talking about gun control are doing so from the safety of you know, having somebody in the lobby with a gun. I don't think that it's particularly foolish at all to have a retired policeman or somebody of that nature in a school. I think that that's a very good thing. I think that's a very positive step that should be taken.
What about some of those weapons, though? You know what the other side is saying on this, that there are certain kinds of weapons that are being used for these kinds of mass shooting incidents, and asking a legitimate question, do these kinds of guns need to be sold in this country?
Right. There's two things here. And first of all, I should say, you know, flatly, I don't own a gun. I'm not a gun expert in any way, shape or form. One of the things I learned in the course of this is that the quote-unquote assault rifle is basically like a hunting rifle that's souped up to look like an assault rifle, but it isn't, so that its looks are more menacing than in fact it is. I mean, in other words, you have to pull the trigger every time for, you know, when you take a shot. You just can't pull the trigger and then it just sprays bullets out there. But you are going to run headlong into people who say that they target shoot with them, that they enjoy doing this, that they want the right to do this, that if you get into all sorts of checking routines, and I don't think that there's I think there are a lot of people who have no problem at all with background checks, but you have to be careful the way you do it. If you live in some rural place somewhere and you've got to, you know, trek into the local police station and do this and do that, and it takes days on end and all this kind of thing. I mean, when you're fiddling around with a constitutional right, I think people get extremely sensitive to it. And I think at the end, I would be very surprised if something of any substance is done.
We're going to go to phone calls in a moment. Let me tell our audience. John Kerry, it's hard to believe that we're saying Secretary of State John Kerry. I'm going to slip, I'm sure, many times because it is so firmly identified with Hillary Clinton. What do you think? Was he a good choice? Does he have a different mission than she did? Will he be strong?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Senator Kerry, there you go, Secretary Kerry. I'm going to have the same problem. Secretary Kerry has a very long record on foreign policy, and whether you agree with him or not, and I don't on most matters, it's very well defined, and he's now the Secretary of State, and he's going to be, you know, on the job immediately, implementing his and the president's views on foreign policy. So, everybody gets there who gets a crack at this job, you know, goes after it. I think one of the curses of this job, and I lay this at the feet of Henry Kissinger and the jet plane, was the notion that the Secretary of State, who once sat in office and got cables from around the world, that they're somehow obligated to step on a jet plane and, you know, run around the world all the time. I think this is why poor Secretary Clinton looked exhausted towards the end of her tenure there.
Yes.
I'm not convinced that that's, you know, that motion per se is a great thing. I think that, you know, that you can do too much of it, and that you wind up in your head, you wind up thinking that motion is progress or that motion is achievement and all of this kind of thing. I think that's a curse. Whether Secretary Kerry will avoid that, I don't know. I think the lure for these people is, you know, it's a nice plane. It's like Air Force One. You get on it and, you know, one moment you're in Brazil and the next moment you're in Saudi Arabia, and you just do that endlessly. I think he's got a big plate. There are, you know, a lot of things on his plate to deal with. What his achievements will be, anyone can guess. I mean, I frankly think we've only had a handful of all the secretaries of state. I think we've only had a handful of, you know, quote unquote great ones. You know, John Quincy Adams for writing the Monroe Doctrine, and maybe William Seward for purchasing Alaska. I'd include Henry Kissinger for China, and George C. Marshall certainly for the Marshall Plan. Beyond that, I think we've had good people and hardworking people, of which Secretary Clinton was one. But to change the world, I'm not sure we've had a lot of them. I think a lot of them have just been, you know, managers of it as much as they can.
Well, there's a focus for another talk show. Who has changed the world, Jeffrey?
That'd
be a good show.
Right.
Wouldn't it? That would be
I'll go
show.
With the Beatles myself.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. Bob Dylan. I'd go with Bob Dylan,
yes,
too. Yeah.
Yes.
We'll start our phone calls in just a moment. It's All Things Political you're listening to here on the Ideas Network. And our guest is Jeffrey Lord. Jeffrey is former Reagan White House political director, also an aide to Jack Kemp, a football player as well, Jack Kemp was, and he is now a contributing editor to the American Spectator. Our phone number for you to join the conversation, we have been talking about football and whether or not we need to change our national sport. Is it too violent? I'm sorry, it's sort of political because the president weighed in on this, saying the sport will have to change to reduce the traumatic hits that can leave players suffering dementia. Does this sport need to change? Is it proper for the president to weigh in on this? We have to do this because it's the day after the Super Bowl. And I had to sit through most of the Super Bowl. John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, the president talking about gun safety once again, and we'll move into the economy, how we create more jobs, and more as we continue our conversation with Jeffrey. A couple lines are open for you, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, should you want to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today would have been Rosa Parks' 100th birthday, and Jean Theo Harris has written a marvelous book about her life. She titles it The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Jean is from Milwaukee, actually. She's a professor of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York, and she has spent the past 10 years writing a definitive biography of a woman who was involved in the civil rights movement in a significant way long before and long after. After she didn't give up her seat on the bus. Jeffrey Lord is with us for all things political, and let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. John in Madison is our first caller. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to mention the firearm subject real quick. Jeffrey, you mentioned guards or armed guards as a possibility. I would just like to ask, why just stick to a privileged group? We already have concealed weapons permits. If states feel comfortable arming citizens, just extend the areas that citizens are allowed to carry. That's just it, really, allowing the population to have safety created by guns, gun safety in a different way. Thank you.
I'm not sure I get the question there. Are we saying, you know, should guards be armed at schools, or are we talking gun safe? You know, zones there. I wasn't quite sure either.
And I think John, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here.
I'm sorry, we didn't quite get the question, John.
All right. It was more of a suggestion or idea. Just rather than having armed guards, people who are paid to be security, allow citizens to provide the security.
I see what you're saying, John. Well, the only thing I would say is I think whoever does this should be trained and knowledgeable in it. I think the assumption is that if you're a retired cop, for example, that you would have some serious weapons training. I'm not sure that the idea of just anybody floating in there with a gun is a good idea. I'm pretty sure that is a matter of fact. But I think if you have somebody who is trained, who has considerable experience, I think that's a good idea. And certainly we have no shortage, I wouldn't think, of retired policemen or security guards, et cetera, who could do the job.
Thanks for the call. Michelle in Oshkosh. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, my comment has to do with football and with guns. I was really shocked and disturbed to see those Sandy Hook children singing America the Beautiful at the beginning of the Super Bowl. They, just 6 weeks ago, watched their classmates murdered. And now we've already moved to seeing them as some sort of sentimental symbol of America's greatness, and we haven't even had the conversation in the meantime about how our children could possibly have had to go through this and our country. And I mean, I just thought it was unbelievably poor taste to bring those poor children out there in front of the entire country to sing a song about God shedding his grace on us and to use them in that way. And I'm just wondering if you, Kathleen, or your guest, has any comment on that.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I kind of walked in and out of the kitchen, and I didn't see that. I wish I had seen it. I read about it. But from what you've said, my impression of that having happened, I would have agreed with you that it would be a little unnerving to me. But is there a way for it to be tastefully done? What did you think, Jeffrey? Were you unnerved?
Michelle, I think you're right. I was a little queasy about that myself. I mean, I understand the motive. These kids have been traumatized, mm-hmm. and some good soul or collection of good souls said, "Oh well, let's give them a treat. Let's bring them to the Super Bowl." I get that. I understand that, but I'm not sure for exactly the reasons that you've expressed that it was a very good idea. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I think is difficult here and not handled so well in a debate of this kind is the exploitation of kids, you know, bringing young kids out to stand behind the president or bringing these kids to the Super Bowl. We can have a conversation, I think, without playing on people's emotions about children. Everybody loves kids. To use them in a way like this, I think, is not a good thing. And I don't think that was the intent of the people at the Super Bowl. I'm sure they just wanted to do a good thing. But I'm not sure. I'm with you. I don't think it was a particularly good thing to do.
Michelle, were you also offended when the president had young people, when he was signing executive order on gun safety and he had children there? There were some who were saying that it was exploiting children in that setting as well. Did you agree or not?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have let, you know, I, my instinct, if this had been my own children, would have been to keep them home and protect them. But at least in the president's case, he was bringing them out to say, I'm going to do something so that this doesn't happen to you again. And in this case, all we were doing is sentimentalizing and singing our national hymn, God Shed His Grace on Thee, and taking this tragedy to show, you know, that we're still God's favorite country or something without any action being behind it other than, you know, it seemed to me purely exploitive. So while I wasn't exactly thinking that was necessary for the president to have done that, at the least he was doing it while he was trying to take some action, and this didn't have that element.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Michelle, for your call. Let's go to Rose in Milwaukee next. Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello?
You're on. Go ahead, Rose.
Oh, okay. I take issue with the guest saying that it's part of human nature to have guns, and football is our national sport, and we just can't change it. You know, I'm 87. And in my lifetime, it was not always this way. I say it's cultural, and the culture has been changing, and it's also based on money. It's based on the gun owner, the gun manufacturers, who are putting all this pressure on. And I think if we started controlling the manufacturers a little bit, we might be able to get at the root of the cause. Thank you.
So, but don't go away, Rose. So that when you were a young woman, you didn't see the emphasis on football as a national pastime. You see that having developed in your lifetime as well as more of a gun culture?
Right, exactly. Football was just another sport like baseball. And I thought baseball was our national sport.
Football I'm with
was
you
for,
on that, Rose. I right. all agree with that.
Students. And baseball was for everybody.
Yeah. I think we all agree that baseball should be. I'm not sure if it is. What do you think? There's been a cultural change, Jeffrey.
Well, I frankly think the big change is television.
Mm.
In terms of what we're talking about in terms of guns and football, mass shootings went on long before there was television in America and elsewhere. And football went on long before there was television. I mean, talking about Ronald Reagan, he famously played George Gipp in a movie about Notre Dame football, and hence the famous line, you know, "Win one for the Gipper." And Reagan himself was called the Gipper for the rest of his life because
sure.
of this. Football was a hugely popular sport back in those days, and has always been. But what has turned it into a business is television. There's no doubt about it. And television, of course, also brings us the news. If there's some terrible thing that happens somewhere in some small corner of America, it becomes, 24/7 television coverage. I frankly think that's the big difference here. Because, in fact, when you go back and look at mass shootings and all this, there were mass shootings. There were people who did these things. I found, as a matter of fact, it might have been in Wisconsin. It was Wisconsin or Michigan where a guy blew up an entire school. Now, he didn't use guns, but he used dynamite. This was somewhere back in the 1920s and killed all kinds of kids. So this kind of thing has been going on. It's just that it's not in your living room every single minute of every single day when it happens, and I do think that's a big change. In terms of the gun manufacturers, Americans and guns have gone back right to the beginning of the Republic. When you go back and look at formative instances in our country's history, like the Boston Massacre or when the British marched into Lexington, Americans, on the one hand, didn't have guns. And, you know, the cry went up immediately when five people were killed in the streets of Boston by the British troops, to arms, get your guns, get your guns. And when the British marched into Lexington, you know, they were met by the colonists with guns. And they were told by the British, I looked into this just the other day, they were told by the British troop leader, to put down your guns. And the response was, don't fire, but if there's to be war, let it begin here. Somebody fired the shot, and the American Revolution was on. So the history of this goes back a long, long way. And I frankly don't think that that's changed at all.
So why don't you have a gun?
It just never interested me. I have relatives who have guns and hunt and all of that kind of thing. I was more into books and politics and things of that nature. It just was. It's not a negative thing, you know. Where you know, one of those things where I don't want it in the house, that kind of thing. It just doesn't interest me.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, some of those kind of things. I'm not a terribly mechanical guy. I've certainly shot guns and you know, done target shooting when I visited these relatives who live, you know, way up in the rural areas of upstate New York, and they have a beautiful home up there, and it's isolated, and you know, at deer season, when we're up there at Thanksgiving, it's deer season, and you know, you can hear gunshots. You don't want to go walking too far.
No, you sure don't. Yeah.
You can hear the gunshots, but it's just never been a particular personal interest of mine. In terms of their right to hold it, I mean, I think, you know, the Second Amendment is right there with the First Amendment to me.
The event you talked about was, Rhonda's looked it up, Bath, Michigan, 1927.
Yeah.
The headline is Maniac Blows Up School Kills 42, Mostly Children, had protested high taxes.
There you go. There you go. But, of course, and at that point, you know, I would venture a guess that most people in America never knew of it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and today, if that happened, good Lord, we'd be talking about how he got the dynamite and who were these kids and all this kind of thing. This would be in your home 24 hours a day for weeks on end. And you know, their parents would have been invited to the Super Bowl for all we know.
Yeah. Rose, thanks very much for the call. I don't mean to talk just about the Super Bowl, but I guess maybe because I had to endure it.
It was such a good game.
I'm sorry. That's what everybody says. It was such a good game, and there I was. What did you think of Beyonce? Was there too much sex on display or not?
Oh, I didn't. You know, it's the Super Bowl. I think this is just the Super Bowl in that sense has become, you know, code for over the top. And I just, you know, fix a nice hot bowl of chili and enjoy the spectacle.
Okay. Enough said. 800-486-8655. Let's move on to another subject, although your phone calls will be applicable on all that we have talked about. 2.2 million jobs created last month. The economy still described, Jeffrey, as sluggish. What would it take to create more jobs this year?
Well, certainly I would say, as a conservative, I would say tax cuts. I mean, I think it's just always the wrong thing to be taking money out of the economy, sending it to government, and, you know, then expecting the economy to recover. The unemployment rate went up. You know, I wrote a piece the other week. President Obama, I find this really very interesting, you know, having worked for Ronald Reagan. President Obama has apparently Ronald Reagan on the brain here and is trying to, in some fashion, according to his aides and various people, sort of bookend the Reagan presidency. In other words, do exactly the opposite of what Ronald Reagan did. And I said, well, okay, if we're going to have this quote-unquote competition, you know, like a presidential Olympics, you know, you can compare month to month to month. I mean, both men got elected twice. Reagan had a landslide, I will say, as a partisan, Reagan had a couple landslides, and Obama had none of that. But now we're down here to the nitty-gritty of this, and the unemployment rate when Reagan began his second term had come down from something like 10.6% to 7.3% when he started off his second term. It's gone up here at the beginning of President Obama's term, so we will see on a month-to-month basis. But I really think unless you're going to get money back into the economy, this is going to be the new norm.
Let's go to Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. I'm wondering if the guests can comment on some economic issues. You know, you've been throwing football around. The fiscal cliff and the other budget debates we've had to date have essentially been training camp, you know, in football terms. The real Super Bowl of economic issues is going to be the sequester, the continuing resolution, which is coming up, and again, the debt ceiling, which they pushed off after those issues are supposedly handled. Does the guest think that the president is going to finally show some leadership and actually address entitlement issues, which really is, you know, in football terms, again, it's the Super Bowl of spending. If we don't take on entitlements, the next generation, speaking of kids, like the last caller concerned about the kids, our kids are doomed with essentially $100 trillion debt we're handing them. They have no chance. So does the guest think there's something the president is going to recognize is the impetus to show some leadership on this?
Jeffrey?
I would have to say no. And frankly, I would say that the no stems from his ideological position. I mean, I think he genuinely believes that these entitlements can just keep sailing on here and nothing's going to happen and he can just keep spending money. I mean, this is clearly an ideological difference here. And I think he is going to, just not do it. He's going to resist it as long as he can, which I think he hopes to be all 4 years. I mean, I think he just doesn't see this happening. And he's going to be at loggerheads here with Republicans in the House and Republicans, period. And, I hate to say this, but I think that, government in general, no matter who's in charge, there's a tendency to just let things ride until the... until the boat goes over the cliff, as it were, or over the waterfall. And I hate to say it, but I think that we are headed down that path here. And I don't think in his mind, he is showing leadership here, that he believes there's nothing wrong, that it doesn't need that much of a fix. And he certainly isn't going to do anything of any drastic nature to change it.
Can you tell me more about this sequester?
Sure. What they did, I think it was in 2011, when they were having these serious conversations of what to do about the budget and all this, that they needed to fix A, B, and C in the budget and all this sort of thing. They put this thing in there, and what it is it's an automatic cut, a sequester, as it were, in which they agreed that if X didn't happen, if they didn't do X, that this would just automatically kick in and sweep through every department of government and take X percent. And it was designed to be so drastic that, the theory was, well, they wouldn't want to go there, and so they would have the political incentive to fix it. Well, they're at loggerheads. I mean, it's basically what it means. You've got President Obama on the one side and Republicans on the other, and it may well be that they're at such loggerheads here that it is going to kick in. It's very noticeable to me that outgoing Secretary of Defense Panetta, who's no right-wing conservative, has said if they do this, this will be devastating to the Department of Defense and national security. And I certainly think there are plenty of Republicans who agree with him on this. However, if there is a feeling that there are a lot of liberal Democrats who think, well, we've wanted to cut defense for some time, so maybe this is the way to do it. That's essentially what a sequester is all about, that once it kicks in, you can't stop it. And whether they will have the ability to stop it at this point, I don't know, because now I think you're getting some people, interestingly, both on the left and the right, who say, okay, fine, let it kick in, and then we'll see what the consequences
are. Mm-hmm. We haven't talked about Chuck Hagel yet, who had a pretty rough go of it last week at his hearings, to say the least. Why did he? Is there? He made some comments that some would interpret as anti-Semitic. Will that do him in here, or will he be confirmed? Do you think he is anti-Semitic?
If I had to guess at this moment, I think he would be confirmed narrowly, perhaps, but I think he would be confirmed. I don't know about the anti-Semitism thing. I mean, he's made these comments. He's backed off on them. It seems to me, as an observer, he's made a number of them, and that would indicate that his head is in a particular place when it comes to this issue. Frankly, I think someone I know writes a column for the Wall Street Journal by the name James Toronto, has what he calls the Toronto principle, and that is that personality A or B, who is perceived to be liberal by the media, is treated so well that when they get outside that bubble and meet people who disagree with them, all of a sudden there's a shock there that they're not treated as revered or brilliant or what have you. Senator Hagel, because he was an opponent of President Bush and he was a Republican, got some of this treatment, he's a veteran and he's so smart and he's got to be right about the surge, and of course he turned out to be wrong and all this kind of thing. Well, so now you get him in front of the Senate for a hearing and his colleagues start to grill him, and it became pretty plain that he really was not that on the ball here. I mean, I think I read somewhere that somebody in the Obama staff anonymously said that they were more or less appalled.
Really?
They were baffled, I think was the word they used by this. I think, well aside from his philosophical inclinations, I'm not sure that he knows what he's doing here. I mean, he certainly left that impression with people on both sides of the aisle. Now, I think this Democrats will rally to the president and probably, you know, get him through. They've got the votes, I think, to get him through. But it certainly wasn't a good start. I mean, I can't think of all the people, Republican and Democrat, who have been up for confirmation for a major position, of anybody who had such a truly wretched time at a Senate hearing like that. I mean, it was truly amazing.
More phone calls in a moment. Jeffrey Lord is our guest this hour for All Things Political. He is former Reagan White House political director and aide to Jack Kemp. He is now a contributing editor to the American Spectator. We've talked about so many things this morning. Talk about any that we've talked about and whatever you want to talk about that's related to politics. And many things are. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hour two of our show today would have been the 100th birthday of Rosa Parks, and we're going to be speaking with Jean Theo Harris, who's written a very thorough and extremely interesting book titled, and the title is something that she carefully chose. We'll ask her why, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. That's coming up. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All Things Political for this Monday, the 4th of February. Diane in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. A well-regulated militia being necessary. I think gun owners should be required to join a militia where they'll be trained and they'll be able to take a few hours and patrol schools, school buses, public meetings, public buildings. They should be able to give up a few hours for their country.
Jeffrey.
Well, I'm not sure I don't know that the mandatory aspect of that would go over very well, but I would imagine there would be a lot of people who would step up to the plate. You know, a lot of gun owners, the NRA gets all this terrific criticism, but they have these incredible training programs for people. And I think a lot of people who own guns are very well trained in the use of them. And I don't think that, you know, some of these people would have a problem giving up their time. I'm not sure that it's something that you would mandate that that's such a good idea, but whether or not you know, you get into the issue of who's got the training and who not, as the earlier caller was talking about, and I think you do have to be very careful about that. You want to make sure that somebody knows exactly what they're doing with a weapon and has the temperament for it and the experience with it, which is why I personally think that people who are professional security guards or retired policemen have a better track record with that.
Let's try and move off guns for a little while. I know there's phenomenal interest, but there's a lot of other issues. Let's look at an issue that, for whatever reason, and you can explain, because you're our expert, Jeffrey, why this is the case. Immigration reform seems to be something that is going to happen, and we are, surprise, surprise, going to have some bipartisan work on this and agreement on this.
Yeah, I think Senator Rubio is wonderfully well positioned to move this discussion along. He himself famously is the son of Cuban immigrants who came here under the Batista rule. I think it was not the ruling or reign. It was not the Castro era, but still, Batista was no day at the beach,
right,
either. So I think he has a particularly particular sensitivity to it. I mean, not only is he the child of immigrants, I believe he's married. His wife is the daughter of Colombian immigrants, and I think he's basically grown up in the Hispanic immigrant community in South Florida. So he is well positioned on this. I think, you know, this it has to be an issue that has to be discussed. I mean, one of the things that I frankly am somewhat interested in is why we're not doing immigration, opening it up some more based on skill. What we're getting here are a lot of folks who are lesser educated and all of this kind of thing. And certainly there is belief that there's a political motivation at this, that if these people were all coming from, say, Germany or Ireland, and they were white and had a different income background and they were going to vote Republican, that there would be a move to shut it off pronto. So I do think you got to deal with that. And I think that Senator Rubio is very well positioned to deal with it. But it is highly controversial. I think what upsets a lot of conservatives is that phrase illegal. I mean, the entire country is based on an idea that and we're all immigrants in one way or another. I mean, there isn't anybody. Even the Native Americans came from somewhere else in the way back of the way back. So to believe that somehow some of us were here, you know, that magically appeared, I mean, this is just crazy. We are all immigrants. The question is, how do you get here? And I think that the illegality of it is what is driving so many people crazy. And not just in terms of Latino immigrants, but in terms of terrorism. People who could, you know, just very easily breach the southern border, who have nothing to do with being Latino, and they're here for a whole nother purpose in this day and age that is not a good one. So I think, you know, making sure that the border security is in place is job one. And I think Senator Rubio said if that's not part of it, you know, he's out of there in terms of this kind of thing. Then you get into the other issue, what to do with the 11 million or so that are here. President Reagan tried this when I was in the White House, and I think there were 3 million people here at the time, and I believe the understanding was there would be more border security and all that. That didn't happen. And so, you know, here we are addressing this issue once again. I think it needs to be addressed and finished so that we're not talking about this 10 years from now.
Yeah.
But the idea of immigration, I mean, I don't know anybody on the conservative side of the aisle that is opposed to immigration. I mean, we're all immigrants in one way or another.
Sure. A couple follow-up questions. Indications are, we did a show on this just a couple months ago, if not sooner, that we have spent a huge amount of money on border security. I mean, huge, huge, huge. The second question is, my question is, how are we going to know for sure that our borders are secure? How do you test that? And secondly, I'd like for you to respond to Senator McCain's comments that a lot of these immigrants would be naturally voting Republicans, and the Republicans really need to move forward on this to get more of the Latino vote.
Yeah, I frankly, in terms of border security, I've not been down there to look at. I mean, I've certainly been in the area, but I've not, you know, looked at border security per se in a close up at hand. But talking to people who have, I mean, it is a difficult task. I mean, it's not like you can just, you know, put up a gate and say everybody come over here. I mean, the terrain in some places is extremely difficult. You would have to do a lot of high tech things with cameras and fences and all of this kind of thing. I mean, it is a very complex task, and it may be, as I'm told, better than it was, but it's still fairly porous. And I think, you know, that's the thing that people are so concerned about. Secondly, with Senator McCain, there was a woman by the name of Heather McDonald, who's a scholar at the Manhattan Institute, and she's really looked into this, and she said, you know, the problem, politically speaking, with Hispanics is that a lot of Hispanics like big government. So that the issue is that immigration is fairly far down their list, that in fact they really do like big government. And so the idea that necessarily because they share certain values here with conservatives or Republicans that they would automatically vote Republican if immigration was taken off the table, I think is not true. As a matter of fact, when immigration was temporarily taken off the table in the Reagan era, I think George H.W. Bush's share of the Latino vote went down from what President Reagan had in the presidential election that followed that immigration reform. So I'm not really sure that in and of itself is a key. And frankly, I'm not sure that it should be. I mean, if these people, as I say, were of another race or something, I mean, the point is not their race. The point is just the illegality of it all. And, you know, if we're supposed to be, you're talking about having a guest on about Rosa Parks, and I certainly thought that the objective of Rosa Parks was to be able to create a colorblind society here where we're talking about ideas, not about someone's race. And it shouldn't matter whether they're Latino or black or white or Irish or German or anything else. It should just matter whether they came in the right way. That's all this should be about. And then appealing to people politically on ideas, because surely the economy and these big government, small government issues, et cetera, affect Latinos as surely as they do African Americans or whites or Asians or any other group in America.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how quickly something happens and what will happen. Jeffrey, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having me.
Yeah. Anytime. We'll have you again if you'll say okay. Jeffrey Lord, our guest for All Things Political this Monday, the 4th of February. He is a former Reagan White House political director. He also worked as an aide to Jack Kemp, and he is a contributing editor to the American Spectator. We thank him for talking about everything. He was game to talk about the game of football and concussions and the American game and guns and the economy and immigration and Secretary of State and a number of issues. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up in just a moment, and then we will celebrate the life of Mrs. Rosa Parks.